Chapter 17. This chapter, while in manuscript, was read by Dr. Charles D. Wolcott, Secretary of the Smithsonian Institution and formerly Director of the United States Geological Survey, and also by Professor Mathis, of the Survey. It may therefore be accepted as a fairly accurate and authoritative presentation of the geological conditions existent at the canyon, with their explanations, as accepted by the leading scientists of today. The beginning of land. In the long ago centuries, when the world was without form and void, waters covered the face of the earth, and darkness brooded over the waters. As the earth's crust began to shrink under the water, in the process of cooling, the first masses to crumple up, to wrinkle, were the first to arise above the surface of the vast primeval shoreless ocean. They appeared as tiny islands, pinnacles, or ridges thrust up, exactly as we see them sometimes on the coast, hidden at high tide, appearing again at low tide. The Laurentian Hills. Nature had plenty of time before her, so she did not hurry her work, and it took long centuries before there was any large amount of land thrust up out of the bosom of the sea. The scientists are able to tell us, with some definiteness, which came forth first. They say that on the continent of America the earliest born elk, and was a mass of granitic rock in Canada, the Laurentian Hills. The next to peer above the surface, and feel the warmth of the sun, were peaks and ridges that made islands of themselves, in what are now known as the Rocky Mountains and the Appalachians. Now, at last, the great waves of the sea, and the resistless storms had something to play with, and they pounced down upon the land, as with tooth and claw. They rubbed and pounded, raged, and smashed for 1,000 years, and then another 1,000, and still another, while Mother Earth uneasily thrust forth her rocky children out of the ocean into the light of day. Surprised at such treatment by the storms and seas, the newly born earth masses began to crumble and either the detached fragments slipped back, or were washed back, into the deeper or shallower parts of the ocean, and were there tossed back and forth, pounded and ground into sand and silt, into pebbles and boulders, while more elk, and was slowly being thrust out for the angry sea to work upon. Layer by layer, the ground-up masses were deposited in the inner ocean bed, parts of which were now practically shut off from the vast ocean beyond. How many centuries of centuries this process continued, geologists do not tell us. Time is so vast, so long, that they cannot divide those early days into weeks, months, and years, as we now do. The continent is born. After many millions of tons had been thus ground up, and tossed about and mingled with the waters of the seas, the earth, in a fit of fiery anger, turned and baked them, with intense heat, out of all semblance to their former appearance. These baked masses, in the course of time, were thrust up out of the seas, mashed and macerated once more, again deposited as sand, silt, pebbles and boulders, and again burned. These processes followed each other, how many times we do not know, the earth all the while keeping up her steady uplift of the children of her bosom out of the great sea. Higher and higher came the land. Further and further receded the sea, until, in due course, the sun shone upon a vast area of land that was the root skeleton of what is now the continent of North America. It would have taken a keen eye, however, to have imagined from that which we see today what was there. The Gulf of California reached far up, even into Nevada, and covered what are now the Mojave and Colorado deserts. There was no California coast range. The Gulf of Mexico was vastly larger than it is today, covering all Florida, and reaching up the Mississippi Valley halfway to the Great Lakes. The first strata. It was just preceding the last uplift of this epoch, that the era of deposition of rock debris was so prolonged, that 12,000 feet of strata were washed into the bed of the sea, in the region now known as the Grand Canyon Country. It was at the time, when life was beginning to dawn, for in the remnants of the strata are found fossils of the earliest known life. These strata, therefore, are of immense interest to the geologist, as they are the first known rocks containing life, to emerge from the primeval sea. Within the last few years, they have been called the Algonquian series, and later I shall speak of them more freely. Prior to the deposition of these Algonquian strata, the Laurentian rocks, the granite upon which they rest, were subject to a long period of planation, as the grinding down and leveling of rock surfaces is termed. After this planation was complete, a subsidence occurred. The whole area became the bed of an inland sea, and upon the planed down granite, the debris that formed the Algonquian strata was washed. While they were being deposited, the whole region was the scene of several seismic and volcanic disturbances, for great dikes and chimneys of lava are found, showing clearly that, by some means or other, the strata were broken and shattered, cracked, and seamed, and that through these cracks the molten lava oozed, forced up from the interior of the earth. It spread out over the Algonquian rocks in small sheets or blankets, which here and there are still to be found today. Tilting of the Algonquian strata. Slowly this 12,000 feet of strata emerged into the sunlight. In the uplifting processes, the surface of the earth, where they were, became tilted, and these strata therefore ipter-ilted away from the perpendicular. As they emerged, weathering and erosion began. It is most probable that this process of degradation began and continued, while the topmost strata were at or near sea level, so that it was a simultaneous process with the uplift. Erosion of the Algonquian. How many centuries this weathering and washing away process consumed no one knows. At the close of this epoch, however, the Algonquian strata had been eroded almost away, owing to its tilted condition, so that in some places even the surface of the Archean was exposed, and suffered the planing down process. Figure 1 on plate facing page 98 is a suggestion as to the possible appearance of the rocks at this time. Even then, in those far away, early ages of history, if one had been present to measure these strata, he would have discovered the astounding fact that, although he had measured them, and found 12,000 feet, before they began to emerge from the ocean, there were but about 500 feet of them left. This is one of the interesting facts in geology, that an observant reader can deduce, so much from so little. The 12,000 feet deposit. B, but, asks the layman, I cannot possibly see how, if only 500 feet of strata are left, anyone could ever tell that there were once 12,000 feet. If 11,500 feet are gone, how do you know they ever existed? A very reasonable question and one very easily answered. Refer to the sketch. Let the bracket on the right show the present width of the remaining strata, viz. 500 feet. Now observe the tilted condition of the remnants. To get the original height of the depositions, begin with number 1 the stratum nearest the Archean and measure that. Suppose it gives us 500 feet. Number 2 gives 200 feet. Number 3 500 feet. Number 4 175. And so on up to number 14. As these strata were deposited horizontally, all we have to do is to mentally replace them in their horizontal position. Throw the tilted strata back again into their original condition, and by this method of measurement it is seen that the 12,000 feet can be made up. Figure 2 facing page 98. Another interesting question here arises: what became of the vast quantity of sand and silt and pebbles that formed and were carried away during such a gigantic process? For, think of it, 11,500 feet of strata, a rock, 2 miles high, almost three times as high a mass as the present distance in vertical height from Eltover to the river. Where has it all gone? Naturally, an answer to these questions is mere conjecture, as only from a study of the facts revealed underneath the present strata can any comparative knowledge be gained of the conditions existent at that prehistoric age. There may have been one river, or a score, or any number between, and it is probable one or more rivers carried the Algonquian debris westward and deposited it, as the Colorado River, not brought into existence until centuries later, is now doing with the debris of the existent strata. Another subsidence. Now, a new era is about to dawn. Planed and smoothed off as they are, the Algonquian and Archean masses are to be submerged once more in the ever-receptive ocean. A period of subsidence occurs, and the whole area is soon hidden under the face of the sea. But, all around these are masses, someday to be mountain peaks, that refuse to sink again into the sea. Then the forces of the air assail them. If they cannot be drowned, they shall be gnawed at, smitten, cut and worried by the air, the chemicals of the atmosphere, the storms, the rain, the hail, the frost, the snow, and thus made to feel their insignificance. Slowly or rapidly, they yielded to this disintegrating process, and as the rocky masses broke up, they were washed by the rills and streams into the bed of the sea, where they soon rested upon the tilted ends of the Algonquian strata and exposed surfaces of the Archean masses, waiting for them. The deposition of the Tonto sandstones. The wise men tell us that this ocean was a salt sea, and that it was quite shallow while these new sediments were being deposited. Little by little 1,000 feet of the sediments of this epoch were washed down, so that it is very likely that the tilted strata upon which they rested slowly sank lower and lower to accommodate them. Then, for some reason or other, there was a rest for a while, a few hundreds or thousands of years, and the masses of sediments became cemented into sandstone and shale, which we call the Cambrian Formation, or the Tonto Sandstone. This is to be seen resting both upon the Archean and Algonquian from the porches of Eltover. It is composed of strata of dull buff, very different from the brilliant reds, almost crimsons, of the Algonquian, and the bright reds of the strata which later were to rest above them. Geological terms. What an audacious science this geology is! How ruthlessly it wrests aside the curtain from the mystery of the past, and how glibly it deals with thousands, millions of years, tying them up into packages, as it were, and handing them out labeled eras and periods. As usual, the names made by the wise men are hard to pronounce, and seemingly hard to understand. But a few minutes will take away the difficulty. They divide the eras into four, viz. :1 Proterozoic, 2 Paleozoic, 3 Mesozoic, 4 Cenozoic. All these oics have to do with life. Proterozoic means before life, and signifies the rocks that contain no fossils indicative of life. Paleozoic signifies the most ancient forms of life. Mesozoic signifies middle life or those between the most ancient and the Cenozoic, or recent forms of life. The periods are lesser divisions of the eras. In the Proterozoic, there are two periods, viz. :, the Archean and the Algonquian. The Paleozoic has six periods, viz. :, the Cambrian, Ordovician, Silurian, Devonian, Carboniferous, and Permian. The Mesozoic era has three periods, the Triassic, Jurassic, and Cretaceous, while the Cenozoic era names five periods, the Eocene, Oligocene, Miocene, Pliocene, and Pleistocene. Absence of certain strata. To shorten our story, let me at once say that during the periods that the Ordovician, the Silurian and the Devonian were forming, the Grand Canyon region was either above water, so that it received none of these sediments, or, if any were deposited, they were almost entirely removed by the weathering processes before described, ere the region again sank into the ocean, to receive the deposits of the Carboniferous epoch. The Carboniferous. During this latter period, more than 3,000 feet of strata were deposited. These are the most striking in appearance of all the canyon strata, for they reach from the Tonto shales to the rim, and consist of three principal strata with many smaller ones in between. The largest is the red wall limestone, which constitutes the base of nearly all the architectural forms found in the canyon, and is the thickest of all the strata. It presents the tallest wall of the series. The two separate walls, one above the other, on the top of the canyon, as seen in the arms of the amphitheater at El Tovar, are the other two wide members of this Carboniferous period. The lower is the cross-bedded sandstone, and the upper the cherty limestone. There is a remarkable difference in the appearance, and the material of which these Carboniferous strata are formed, and those of the East and Europe. We generally think of coal beds, carbon, when this period is mentioned. Here there are none. In the East, in England, and in other parts of Europe, vast marshes existed in this period, and the rank vegetation of these marshy areas formed the coal beds, with which the Carboniferous there abounds. It is only by the fossils found that the periods to which the various strata belong are determined, and the fossils, millions of which abound in the upper limestone, are clearly of the Carboniferous epoch. As these strata and this period bring us to the rim of the canyon, it might be easy to imagine that the processes of uplift and subsidence, and deposition of more strata, as far as the canyon region is concerned, now cease. Such, however, is not the case. Later strata. As we go away from the canyon, either north or east, we find thousands of feet more of the later depositions, and the geologists affirm that many of these at one time may have overlaid the canyon region. There is circumstantial evidence, amounting almost to proof, and figure 3 of plate facing page 99 suggests what that evidence is. It should be carefully noted that the canyon has been cut through the highest portions of a ridge, which runs generally from east to west, and the slopes of which, therefore, were north and south from the ridge. As one travels north from the canyon, he finds all the way along, for hundreds of miles, that he goes on a downslope for a number of miles, and then suddenly comes to the jutting edges of slightly tilted strata only 2 degrees, which make a cliff up which he must climb. Arrived at the top of this, the downward descent begins again, until another ridge of the slightly tilted strata appears. See figure 3 of plate facing page 99. Thus he continues up into Utah, and south and east into Arizona. Now, in imagination, restore these cliffs of Permian, Triassic, Jurassic and even Cretaceous strata over the whole canyon platform. Figure 4 of plate facing page 99. Red Butte, which is the prominent landmark seen from the railway on the right, when going from Williams to the canyon, is said to be a remnant of the Permian. Deposition of strata in shallow water. It is, I believe, generally accepted by the geologists that the accumulation of much of the sediments of the Cambrian, Carboniferous, Permian, Triassic, Jurassic, and Cretaceous periods took place in shallow water, and that the sea bottom slowly sank under the weight of the increasing deposits. Hundreds, thousands of years must have elapsed during the process, for the indications are that the sinking did not exceed a few inches every 100 years. As carefully measured, these sediments then amounted to about 2 miles. Imagine, then, these Cambrian rocks, that at El Tovar, are clearly seen above the granite or Archean, sunk in the ocean, to the depth of 2 miles, and covered over with the various strata, the topmost of which was barely above sea level at periods of low tide. Cretaceous uplift. Then began another epoch of uplift. Slowly the Cretaceous rocks emerged from the sea, and were subject to the fierce attacks of nature that produce erosion. Now we have to grope blindly for a while, as the wise ones do not have facts enough upon which to speak with definite certainty. But it is assumed that a great warping of the Earth's crust took place, and that in this revolution some of the plateau sank, supposedly the northern part, though it certainly extended across the canyon nearly as far south as Williams and Ash Fork, and other parts the edges arose, and thus formed a basin which became another vast inland sea. Eocene Lake. We know this was an inland sea, and had no connection with the ocean, For all the fossils and sediments deposited in it reveal that they are freshwater organisms. In the sea, as in the earlier oceans, vast deposits of sediment were made in the early Eocene period, and another period of subsidence occurred. Then the Great Lake was drained, and the uplift began, slow and sure. Then, and not before, were the conditions existent that have made the canyon country as we see it today. Peaks and islets received the rainfall. Tiny rivers were formed, that grew larger, and cut their way in deeper, as the uplift continued. The principal stream, which was then born, was the Colorado. It is supposed, from various evidences, that the rainfall was very much more abundant then than now, and consequently the rivers had greater flow, and more eroding and carrying capacity. The uplift continued, and the geologists tell us it did not cease until about 15,000 feet, deposited since Cretaceous times, were thrust up into the air. As almost all this mass of deposition has disappeared from the immediate canyon region, we are compelled to believe that it has been swept away down the Colorado River, to join the sands of the Carboniferous, and later periods in the Colorado Desert, the Salton Basin, the Great Low Region of Lower California, and the Gulf itself. Less by erosion in the canyon region. Now figure out for a few moments the results of these different erosive periods. 11,500 feet of Algonquian gone. A small amount of erosion in the Cambrian epoch, the depth of which is unknown. And then the great denudation of the Eocene period sweeping away upwards of 15,000 feet of strata, give us a total of 26,500 feet that have totally disappeared from the canyon region. A vertical mile is 5,280 feet. Mount Washington is about 6,500 feet above the sea, a trifle higher than Mount Low, near Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.